This is the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March 27, 2017, brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPE, a division of the Lascalzo Institute, and your State Society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and from here in Phoenix, I'm going to be talking to you about some of the developments that took place over this past week in the area of federal taxes. The IRS began actually releasing some information this week. We had an announcement from the commissioner that the IRS was actually going to start issuing sub-regulatory guidance here shortly. So they believe now that they have the go-ahead that it's okay to issue things that are not formal regulations. And we actually saw a couple of these things come out this week. So we actually have something to talk about a little more than just some obscure court cases, which we've been stuck with in recent weeks. And some of the developments we have this week, we'll talk about the fact that the IRS announced this week that the small business self-employed taxpayer or the self-employed, small business self-employed divisions, fast-track settlement program has now been made permanent. We had an issue come up with a disbarred attorney who discovered that getting disbarred is one way not to have to worry about the OPR, at least for production of documents. We also discovered bad news for a corporation that the tax court agreed that a corporation could not suffer economic hardship that would qualify for relief from levy. And the IRS gave new rules for obtaining employee consents for employers that are filing for refunds of payroll taxes. Well, we are still in tax season. I know you guys are probably not thinking a whole lot about continuing education yet, but we are going to get there faster than you think. And for those of you in Oregon, you're aware that one of the complications in Oregon and a few other states is that CPE renewal dates, and I should say CPA renewal dates, come up the end of June. And that gives you very little time from the end of tax season until the renewal date if you have some missing CPE. So I wanted to remind you that I'm going to start my CPE season in Portland, Oregon area. And they are available on the Oregon Society's website right now at orcpa.org. I have a course coming up on May the 17th for assisting the survivors, the CPA's role in the decedent's estate. In that course, we'll talk about the various tax issues and related to when someone dies. That includes things like dealing with a retirement plan, the issues that come up regarding dealing with accounting for an estate, so look at the Principal and Income Act of the state of Oregon. We'll talk about Oregon's own estate tax that we have to worry about in that regard. We'll also talk about just dealing with some of the other problems that we have with trust returns and similar problems. So that'll come up on the 17th. And then on the 18th, I'll be doing a day for real estate partnerships. The course is real estate partnerships, get in, get out, get taxed. We'll talk about partnership taxation, specifically how it relates to real estate. Because of course, as many of us are aware, a large use of partnerships is in the area of holding real estate and real property. So we're going to talk about the intersection of those two. That's again on the 18th. Both courses are in the Portland, Oregon area at the Oregon Society offices in Beaverton. And again, you want to sign up for one of these, go online to www.orcpa.org, check the CPE links, and you'll find links to these courses. Now let's get into the development for this week. First one we're going to talk about here is Revenue Procedure 2017-25. In this case, the Small Business Self-Employed Taxpayer Fast Track Settlement Program has been made permanent. This program was initially started as a pilot program by announcement 2006-61, was extended a couple of times, most recently in announcement 2011-5. What's happened in this case now in Revenue Procedure 2017-25 is the program has been taken out of pilot status, been made available nationally, and been made permanent. Now, what this idea of this is supposed to be is if taxpayers who are subject to this are in exam and we have unagreed issues in at least one open year under examination, the agent basically and the taxpayer can ask for appeals to step in and effectively mediate a settlement at the exam level. So it resolves both, it can be used for both factual and legal issues. And once an issue is fully developed, you can ask to go in. Now it is a request issue. It is one that both the taxpayer and the IRS have to agree to. So if either one decides they don't want to use this, it won't be used. but it is an option to deal with a case and get to appeals on a specific matter faster than you would otherwise. Now, you get to appeals, but the appellate conferee is going to be serving not in traditional appeals role, but will be serving to try to mediate an agreement between exam and the taxpayer. Now, the procedure outlines some changes that were made from the old program under Announcement 2011-5, and those you'll find in the notice. Some issues that we have, you know, are pretty much, you know, what we've seen before for this program. There are a few things that there. We have issues here that you cannot take anything that's docketed in tax court, can't be there. Certain things are excluded. We've had that round us go in there. Also, there are special rules that help protect the IRS from whipsaw issues, where you can't end up with with two different results coming out. Now, generally, the ruling, this service, FTS, is available if the case contains disputed factual or legal issues, the issues have been fully developed at the exam level, and the issues remain unresolved after involvement of the group manager. Previously, it was not clear the group manager had to be involved before this got started, although in reality, the group manager almost always was in a case like this. But now it's clear the agent has to bring the group manager into the process. Now, there's a whole list of cases that cannot come into this program, and they are listed in the list in this notice. So there's this whole slew of things that you can't take into the court. For instance, TEFRA cases cannot come in there. Collection cases are not allowed into this area. Anything that's outside the jurisdiction of a small business self-employed area obviously can't come into this area. So all of those are things we have to do. Now, both parties consent to this. If you agree, the examiner and the taxpayer complete Form 14017, which is the application for fast tax settlement, along with a documentation package. That documentation package will include the examiner's documented work papers and the taxpayer's written response. The package goes first to the group manager, who determines if the package is complete and if the manager decides the case is suitable for the program. If the manager approves, it then goes to appeals, who again get to review, determine if this is an appropriate case and if they want to take it on. These decisions not to go into, the IRS decides that they're not going to allow you to use a fast track program, that decision is not subject to appeal or judicial review. Now, the program itself, as we said, is primarily a mediation type program. The idea here is we're going to use alternative dispute resolution methods to try to get the agent and the taxpayer to agree on a resolution to the problem. Now, the appeals official has a right to propose settlement terms on any or all issues, and they can consider offers by either party and make the proposal to the other. If the taxpayer accepts the appeals official's proposal, but the group manager rejects it, then it has to go to the SBSE territory manager, must review the rejection. So essentially, there's a bit of pressure put on the group manager to accept it if it's been proposed by the appeals officer who's been assigned to the case and the taxpayers accepted it. If the group manager wants to reject, they're essentially going to have to get the territory manager to go along with this. If there are any matters not resolved during the program, the taxpayer still has all the standard appeals rights. But remember, the negative there is, of course, you spend a lot of time and money here at this other program. That's the one thing not to forget. But one thing you do give up is you cannot use post-appeals mediation for anything that was considered during the FTS system. Either party can withdraw essentially at any time unless there is a proposed settlement on the table. So in essence, the IRS, the group manager can't get out of this territory manager review. You know, if the appeals official has proposed a settlement, the taxpayers accepted it, the group manager can't say, well, I'm not going to reject it, I'm just going to withdraw. They can't withdraw at that point. They have to follow through and finish it up. Now, the program is effective as of the date of publication, so that means you can use it as of today. So if you have one that's appropriate for it, you might consider using it. Next case up, we have a case coming up. This is a district court case from Nevada, the case of Sexton versus Hawkins. And this is a case involving the authority of the Office of Professional Responsibility of the IRS. all of us should be aware the OPR generally is the office that looks at the regulation of tax professionals who are circular 230 professionals. Generally, that's going to include attorneys, accountants, and enrolled agents. Now, this particular case involved a practitioner who was currently under suspension by OPR. But in addition to being suspended, because it turned out that he essentially had pled guilty to 4 counts of mail fraud and 1 count of money laundering back a number of years ago, as part of that, in addition to a suspension by OPR, he was disbarred by the state of South Carolina. And based on what we have in the case and before us, he's never actually been readmitted to the bar in South Carolina or anywhere else. Now, despite being disbarred and suspended, he continued to offer tax services to the public. And he offered services to a Ms. Kern, who he assisted in preparing her 2010 and 2011 tax returns. And then he went forward and he offered to send a written memorandum to her analyzing her tax options, giving her sort of an opinion on her tax situation. Before she accepted that offer of getting that written advice, she discovered his disbarment. Apparently, he hadn't told her. And she was a little upset that she hadn't been informed he'd been disbarred. So she got upset. She sent him an email. She fired him. And she filed a complaint with the IRS Office of Professional Responsibility regarding Mr. Sexton. The OPR investigated the complaint and sent a request for information from Mr. Sexton. Now, Mr. Sexton argued that they had no right to demand disclosures from him. He said he's no longer in practice before the IRS as that term is used under Title 31 of the United States Code, Section 330. Now, the regulations that implement that section are what we call Circular 230. Thus, we look at, is Circular 230, does it apply to a suspended practitioner who, following losing his membership in the South Carolina bar, would no longer qualify as a Circular 230 practitioner if he wasn't under suspension? So that's the issue, plus the broader question of just what actions are covered by Circular 230. Now, Mr. Sexton said, asked the Nevada District Court, to accept the decision of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in the Loving case, you may remember that from 2014, that practice before the IRS does not include return preparation. The Loving Court, remember, was the issue there was involving when the IRS was trying to require all return preparers to pass an exam and get this registered return preparer certification. And in Loving, the D.C. Circuit stopped that program cold in its tracks, by holding that, in fact, the IRS, the OPR, had no authority to regulate the preparation of tax returns, that was not practiced before the IRS. The court in Nevada accepted this view. And that's important because this is the first court outside the D.C. Circuit to have openly said that the Loving case is correctly decided and we're accepting the Loving view. So we now have a case. By the way, this case, if appealed, would go to the Ninth Circuit. So just be aware, if it's going to go up the chain, if the IRS wants to go up the chain, it's going to go to the Ninth Circuit for their decision. And we'd see if they agree with the D.C. Circuit. But in this case, the court began by rejecting the IRS contention that a suspended practitioner are still under their jurisdictions if their rights have been suspended but not terminated, even though he's no longer an attorney. And the court said they found no authority whatsoever for this position. They noted that the OPR has no authority to regulate tax return preparation. They accepted the Loving case. They go down that line. Now, while Circular 230, 10.51A8, prohibits unauthorized individuals from practicing for the IRS, that doesn't help in this case. The court, no question, Mr. Sexton was an unauthorized individual. The court noted that he wasn't in practice before the IRS because he was merely preparing tax returns. That wasn't practice. So for return preparation work, the IRS had no authority to request documentation from Mr. Sexton. Remember, that's all he ever really did for this woman. But the IRS said, wait, but he offered to give her advice. And there's a separate provision under Title 31, U.S. 330, Section 330E, specifically provides nothing in this section or any other provision of the law shall be construed to limit the authority of the Secretary of the Treasury to impose standards applicable to the rendering of written advice with respect to any entity, transaction, plan, or arrangement, or other plan arrangement, which is of a type which the Secretary determines as having a potential for tax avoidance or tax evasion. The IRS said, okay, we can't go after him under the general rule of representation for the IRS, but we think we can go after him under the fact he was offering to give written advice, and as such, we should have the right to request documents from him based on that. Well, the court had a few problems with this. They first said, Loving argues for a narrow reading of the statute. So the court is kind of leaning toward the idea that this sort of representation, you know, this particular written advice theory, wouldn't broadly apply to the type of advice that he was offering to give. There was no deep discussion of what advice he was offering to give, whether it related to a tax shelter or similar arrangement. Note that language you see there is a language that is borrowed from virtually, not totally word for word, but very close, to 6662 in the definition of what is a tax shelter for penalty purposes. It was also, you may remember, language very similar to that had been in Circular 213 of the covered opinion rules, which, you know, if you take a look at how we interpret 6662, that's not every piece of advice. That's just advice for things that would meet the tax shelter requirements. But let's assume that, in fact, it is broader than that. The court said it still wouldn't apply the way the IRS views it. You know, the IRS says he basically can prepare returns. Any written advice would come to the AG's jurisdiction. Here's the problem. The court said all the statute says is standards on such advice, but it has no mechanisms to sanction such advice. Remember, they're investigating him for sanction. Well, there's nothing they can do to him if he is, you know, whatever he's doing with this. And in this case, he didn't even give such advice. He'd offered to give advice. She never actually accepted the engagement, remember. As well, the court had found the IRS didn't produce any authority to support its view that written advice need not be given whereas an actual proceeding or investigation before the IRS taking place, that written advice could go outside the context of representation before the IRS. The problem is the Section 330 is not well written in that regard. Does written advice rule apply outside of all context, or is it only part of the context of representation? So in short, Section 330 did not allow, I should say Title 31, Section 330 did not apply to Mr. Sexton, and as such, the OPR had no right to ask him for documents or essentially to investigate and potentially try to discipline him under the rules of Circular 230 because he wasn't in practice for the IRS, he wasn't a Circular 230 practitioner, and he never actually gave advice. For all those reasons, tough luck, IRS. Next up in the tough luck, this time the tough luck is not with the IRS, but with the taxpayer. This is the case of Lindsay Manor Nursing Home, Inc. versus Commissioner 148 TC number 9, issued on March the 23rd. And this is one of those cases where the taxpayer actually lost twice in two different cases on the same day. Actually, it's all part of the same fact pattern, but they divide into opinions. We're going to talk about the published tax court decision here today in the Lindsay Manor case. But you may see some sources refer to this as Lindsay Manor 1 and the other case, Lindsay Manor 2, because there are two on the same day. But the question in this case is, under Internal Revenue Code Section 6343A1D, that deals with situations where the IRS releases a levy and situations where the IRS, you know, basically is allowed to release a levy for taxes. And that particular subsection deals with economic hardship. The question becomes, can a corporation avail itself of the economic hardship relief to either keep a levy from being applied or get a levy removed? Now, the law states effectively that under regulations prescribed by the IRS that they can release the levy upon property or rights to property levied upon any person If the secretary determines that such a levy is creating an economic hardship due to the financial condition of the taxpayer. The corporation says, well, look, under 7701 of the code, a taxpayer is a person subject to tax under the code. And that same section, 7701, says a person includes a corporation. So taxpayer, they said, means this can apply to a corporation, and we think we're going to suffer an economic hardship. That unpaid payroll taxes of $108,911 from the fourth quarter 941 for 2013. The IRS was now ready to levy, and it issued a notice of, you know, the basically proposed levy. The taxpayer filed for collection due process hearings and argued for the IRS that they should not impose the levy due to economic hardship. The taxpayer in its letter basically said, look, if we have to, because they were trying to levy their Medicare, Medicaid money. If they levy that and they're not going to get that money, they're not going to have enough money to meet expenses, provide care, and they're going to have to shut down this nursing home, and all of these elderly patients are going to lose care because they can't meet the state and federally mandated standards if they don't have that money to do so. The settlement officer though so refused to consider the argument, holding that corporations are barred from using this provision per the regulations. Those regulations provide a levy is creating economic hardship due to financial condition of an individual taxpayer. Notice they put the word individual in there. The condition applies to satisfaction of the levy and holder in part will cause an individual taxpayer to be unable to pay his or her reasonable basic living expenses. Now, the regulation, obviously, A, limits it to an individual, and number two, the regulation, when it defines economic hardship, talks about paying basic living expenses. Those aren't going to be incurred by a corporation. Well, the taxpayer said, okay, that's the regulation, but that regulation has to be invalid because clearly under the law, Congress meant this to be available to corporations. So the question becomes for the court, does the IRS have a right to write this regulation in this form? So the court goes down and does what's called a Chevron test. Now, we have some provisions in Congress right now to remove the Chevron test, and how that'll impact this would be open, but we'll still discuss the Chevron test because under this case, that's what we were applying to. Under the Chevron test, we look at two things. First thing is the statute ambiguous or does it clearly tell us how things should happen? And then number two, if the statute is ambiguous, is the agency's interpretation a reasonable interpretation of the statute? If it is, then the agency's interpretation will be given the effect of law. Well, the taxpayers said they're not going to get past the first point because the law clearly allows for a corporation to claim this test. But the court wasn't so sure. The court said other provisions under 6343 referred to taxpayers for situations that clearly could only ever impact an individual. For instance, there's a section dealing with the levy against wages received by the taxpayer. Corporation can't be an employee, has to be an individual. So taxpayer in that context meant only individuals. So it isn't necessarily the case, use the term taxpayer implied Congress intended that you had to have some way for a corporation to meet every one of these circumstances. Secondly, they noted Congress granted the IRS the authority specifically to define the term economic hardship. And the court found that that was intentionally left ambiguous and available for the IRS to define. Third, the court said, if you really want to be literal, that particular code section only talks about release of a levy. In this case, we're talking about applying it before a levy's been actually applied. Now, the service is always interpreted that way and allowed it to be used that way, but the court's essentially saying that if you want to be literal, then it has no application in this standpoint. You have to wait for it to be applied first if you want to go literal code, because they're saying that's what the literal code says. But they go back down and they say, okay, here's our problem. The statute's not clear. Now the question becomes, is the IRS's interpretation valid? And the court found, taking a look at the legislative history, taking a look at, you know, at comments to the regulations and other background comments when the regulations were proposed, that in fact, this appeared to be a reasonable interpretation for economic hardship was the basic living expense test, which obviously a corporation can't meet. In fact, the court noted at one point, the discussion turned on, the IRS had considered a corporation in a different context, a corporation economic hardship test, but then decided against it in a final regulation, noting that it would put the IRS in the position of deciding which businesses that are failing should or should not be allowed to fail, and that that didn't seem like a proper decision for the service to be making. And so therefore, economic hardship was not something the service should be looking at. Now, the court also said the corporation is not necessarily totally done here. There are other options. And you know, for instance, the IRS is supposed to do an intrusiveness analysis with regard to how they're going to collect the tax, and are they using the least intrusive method necessary to obtain the tax dollars in question. And they said the corporation could demonstrate there that, you know, essentially the economics impacts on them makes this an overly intrusive and otherwise unnecessary way of collecting the tax. Now, that's all nice and good. Unfortunately for the taxpayer in this case, the court didn't decide that in the published opinion, but on the same day they issued a memorandum decision, TC Memo 2017-50, that concluded this corporation didn't meet the condition for that relief either. So this corporation lost twice. Finally, Section 6402, under Section 6402, the IRS in Revenue Procedure 2017-28 revised the rules for obtaining employee consents for FICA and Railroad Retirement Tax Act tax refunds. Now, this particular ruling makes minor changes to the proposed notice found in Notice 2015-15. If a taxpayer discovers that they have overpaid FICA taxes, the employer is, you know, and let's say we discover now here in 2017 that we overpaid FICA taxes in 2015. The employer, if they're going to go for a refund of those taxes, has to protect the rights of the employees. So one of the things they have to do is they have to get a consent for every employee. If they had withheld the taxes from the employee, they have to get a consent from the employee for them to go attempt to get the refund. And generally, they have to agree to pay it back to the employee. They also need to get a statement from the employee. The employee him or herself has not filed their own claim for refund with the service. Or the other way out is they could show they simply never withheld the tax. They don't need the consent. This talks about meeting those requirements. A couple of changes were made. Some people had wanted them to shorten the wait period. You had to wait 45 days after asking for consent before you could, you know, assume the consent was not coming. Now, what they said, the IRS did not reduce that initial day, but, you know, in these cases, though, you know, the time to respond to a second request, though, they did agree to reduce from 45 days to 21. So you don't have to wait out 90 days for the consents to be received if you don't receive any. They also allowed to use a truncated EIN to combat identity theft, and they added disclosure that a taxpayer in this particular case, an employer, has got to tell the employees that they cannot go after the overpaid additional Medicare tax. That's taken care of in the employee's Form 1040. Now, the ruling tells us specifically what a consent has to contain, specifically what's going to be considered reasonable. We have the language for the additional Medicare tax notice, example language you can use, also things you can include, and things that must be in the received consent. General rules, they also tell you, you know, how you can show you took reasonable steps when you're unable to contain the consent. So if you have a taxpayer that's looking to go for a refund of FICA taxes, be aware that Notice 2017-28 is out there. Now, this notice is going to be effective prospectively. So the date in question, it's going to apply for consents requested on or after June 5th. Currently, you can still use the old proposed notice, the proposed ruling in the Notice 2015-15. And if you already issued the request before June 5th, even if you receive it after that date, you can still comply with the old rule. Well, we're getting toward the end of tax season. The end is nearly in sight here in 2017 for tax season. So hopefully you're all surviving well. want you to remember, keep your eyes open for those state society CPE catalogs that'll be coming out shortly. Some of the states, like I mentioned earlier today, Oregon, have already posted their continuing education course offerings for this year on their website. Others have not yet, but some are there. And most of them will get their printed catalogs out right around the tax day, because we all know, you know, once tax season is over, you got to start thinking about your continuing education. Make sure you consider your state society continuing education options for the coming year. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of March 27, 2017. Be sure to catch our daily updates at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com daily, or however often we can get around to writing updates this time of year. You can also download a PDF with articles with all today's topics on the weekly update page. And if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me online on Twitter. I'll be at edzollers there. So take care, have a good week, and we'll look forward to seeing you next week here on the current federal tax developments.